The Gambling Files Podcast, the podcast with zero fucks to give. Welcome to another episode of the Gambling Files Podcast. I'm your solo host for this episode, John Bruford. Fintan is, I guess, just too busy and too important to join us today. I'm just kidding. He's just got stuff on. You know, he is busy, he is important, but that's not why he's not here, honestly. We have a lovely episode today. We're joined by the always brilliant Steve Ruddock, who is joining us, interestingly, from props.com, not wagers.com, or fuck, I don't know, I can't keep up. All these rebrands, you know? I'm still struggling with in scientific games and but anyway, Steve Ruddock, that's the constant. And Steve is joining us to talk a bit about the Wire Act and the recent court ruling that IGT was involved in. And Steve is his usual brilliant self. Something that I was asked to bring up on the podcast is somebody was asking me recently, well, Kate Bloody Chambers was asking me, yeah, that Kate Chambers. She was asking me about were there any gambling companies in the UK or well, it could be anywhere. Did any athlete sponsorship, as in individual athletes, because funding for athletes is just incredibly difficult. Because if you think about it, for every Usain Bolt, you know, there are, what, 8 starting berths on the 100 metres at the Olympics. And they'll all have run probably 2 heats to get there. So that's, you know, that's more than 8. Plus all of the aspiring sprinters, etc., etc. Plus there are people who are doing the shot put, the discus, the high jump, the long jump, the triple jump, all those slightly less sexy sports. And certainly in the UK, one of their primary forms of sponsorship is through funding from the National Lottery. Certainly has been historically. And of course, with the 2012 Olympics, funding went through the roof, really, for athletes. And it was rewarded with an absolutely stunning array of medals, not to mention a really phenomenal event. But of course, you don't have the Olympics every year. And for a lot of athletes, you don't even have them every 4 years, and they've still got bills to pay, etc. So, are there any gambling companies out there that are sponsoring athletes, or any that would be interested in sponsoring athletes? Because I think that there is a connection to be made there. Obviously not to influence them, just to say, there you go pay your bills, enjoy. Well, you know, obviously it's not that simple. You know what I'm saying, though. And then, you know, there is the potential to do something really quite cool, help somebody really cool, do some good shit in the community with a real athlete. I'm a huge fan of athletics. I'm a huge fan of sport in general. And I know that, you know, some of the sports I'm most passionate about, triathlon, ultra running, and other long form sports, you know, they don't have the big money. They're still very, very often competed by amateurs. On the whole, are competed by amateurs, even at the highest level. And there are some big name athletes, but, you know, not that many. So, yeah, I mean, fuck, you can sponsor me if you like. One eagle-eared listener did suggest that we should do some merchandise. They suggested T-shirts, and I've got to say, you know what? It's a great idea. I mean, I can kind of see... Oh, God, I nearly said something really inappropriate then. I might wait and discuss that one with Fintan because I think it's a hilarious idea. See, I think that the gold standard for merchandise is Spam. If you've never seen it, go on the Spam website and look at the Spam merchandise. It is amazing. I've got some. I've got some because I'm lucky enough to know the lady that does Spam's PR in the UK. And she knows that I'm a huge fan of Spam branded goods. I've got a Spam spatula. I've got a Spam apron. I've got a Spam rugby shirt, although the logo's faded off it now. I've got a Spam slicer. I've got some good quality Spam stuff. It's not even the tip of the iceberg. There's a Spam hat in, I think, what the Americans call Hunter's Orange, with the Spam logo embroidered on the front in this beautiful royal blue. What a hat that is. I'm going to have to get myself one. But just imagine a Hunter's Orange hat with the gambling files across the front. Oh. Anyway, Steve Ruddock, enjoy the episode. More soon. Oh, after this word from our sponsors, who I know I haven't mentioned yet, but they are Sporting Tech, who also get a... This is Mike. Mike's boss asked him to find a new iGaming platform for the company's multi-million dollar new project. Mike found one, but it wasn't very good. In fact, it was shitty. Now Mike's partner has left him. He has no friends, and he recently caught crabs. Possibly from a dirty toilet seat. Don't be like Mike. Choose Sporting Tech. Sporting Tech, for all your iGaming platform needs. Other iGaming platforms are available. And we move to our only guest on this episode. If you haven't guessed yet, we're doing that one person, one episode thing. I'm bringing my microphone a little bit closer for that special intimate feel that you only get with this podcast. Chuckling in the background is my co-host, Fintan Costello. And we are joined by none other than Steve Ruddock of Props.com, formerly known as the artist Steve Ruddock of Wagers.com. But we don't talk about that because that's in the dim past. Props.com, interestingly, started life as a theatrical suppliers website. Later was bought by a company that made airplane parts, and now, fuck knows what it is, but Steve works there. Steve, welcome.
How's it going, guys?
It's all right, yeah. Fint?
Yeah, I'm all good. I'm just like props.com's great domain. Like wagers.com was a great domain name. Props.com is a great domain name. I would love to chat whoever's buying the domain names, because I think that's a great conversation. I love interesting domain names.
I once bought a domain called badgerfight.com. No, it's a true story.
Because slash tips.
I had this idea of, and there was one fucking flaw in this, right? My idea was I was just going to do this like photo story of a human-sized badger living in the world who was like living pretty similar to a badger, but also pretty similar to a person. So like they'd be at work and there'd be a bit of conflict and they would tear the face off the person that they had the conflict with and then go back to the desk. But I couldn't find a full-size badger outfit anywhere. So I had to let the domain lapse.
I think we can build on this idea. Badgerfights.com should be dedicated to two men in badger outfits fighting WWE style.
Yeah. I think you could buy some like replica Wolverine claws.
Yeah.
Throw them on. Yeah.
Get some of those Hulk fists and paint them black and white.
The usefulness though may have already gone by. Like you during that whole honey badger thing, that might have been a multi-million-dollar website.
What whole honey badger thing?
You don't remember that when that guy made the voiceover for the honey badger video? He's like, honey badger don't give a shit.
Have you?
No idea what you're talking about.
You don't know. Oh, how old am I? Holy shit!
No. I remember this. It's just John's not cool. That's all. A honey badger will attack anything. It is utterly fearless. And so there was videos of like honey badgers attacking lions and like kicking the shit out of a lion. And like, it's not a big animal. It's just absolutely ferocious and.
Yeah, they just go to like a wasp nest and grab the whole nest and just be getting stung left and right and just be eating it and not care.
Well, but anyway, I stand by the concept for the web. I mean, I'm going to have to look that up now.
What happens if two honey badgers fight? That could be a thing. Are they as ferocious with each other? Must have, right?
Crazy bastards. So, you know, I mean, my badgerfight.com dream could still happen. Who knows? Maybe somebody's listening that has a badger costume that they'd be willing to, let's say, rent, first of all. But, you know, you don't know if it's going to take off. And they might want it returned. Would you want a badger costume returned from me? I wouldn't. Not saying I do anything dodgy in it, but I wouldn't.
Anyway, I don't know, John. I'd see you straight onto furries.com or something and find your local meetup and off you go for a cuddle party.
Everything done with a badger outfit is dodgy. Like, there's no like legitimate use for that.
Maybe that's why I couldn't find one. Yeah, whoever's buying your domains, I respect them as well. But if they need any tips, I'm available and my consultancy fee is surprisingly low. But Steve, that's not why you're here today. We're not recording video, but I am gesticulating in a theatrical fashion. I wanted to talk to you about, oh, also I'm very glad somebody's started a HGV diesel engine just outside my office. If anybody can hear that rumbling, it's not me. There are no badgers present. Nobody's growling. There was a recent story and I thought to myself, I know who specializes in aspects of that. Steve fucking Ruddock, I thought. Razor himself, I thought. So that story, Steve, what's it all about? I'm talking about the IGT court ruling recently. Yeah, can you give us a bit of background?
We have another development in the never-ending saga of the Wire Act and online gambling. I'm trying to think of the proper place to start on this. So we could start in 1961, we could start in 2002, 2011, 2018, or recently.
Pick a year. I mean, we got to assume that the audience knows some of this shit.
Yeah, so the Wire Act has been used against online gambling sites because of the limitations against transmitting data. So obviously the internet transmits data across state lines, so we have to find a law that applies to the internet. And since we don't have any, we go back to 1961 and find the Wire Act. So in about 2002, Nevada was looking at possibly legalizing online casinos. Actually, I think it was like 2001. But they asked the Department of Justice, hey, is there anything that would prevent us from doing this? And at the time, Michael Chertoff, who was heading that, said, yes, there's this thing called the Wire Act, and we believe that it applies to all forms of gambling, even though it specifically says sports betting in one place. But there is a funny use of a comma in one of the clauses that makes it pretty much unreadable. So the Wire Act can say whatever you want it to say. So from 2002 to 2011, that's how it was. That's why we had offshores in the US. There was no legal online betting. 2011, from a 2009 question from Illinois and New York, who wanted to know if their online lottery sales, so they did some basically like second chance drawings and things like that at the time. And they wanted to get into subscription sales. They said, hey, does this violate the Wire Act because the processing center is in a different state? And the Department of Justice says, no, it only applies to sports betting. And funny enough, within a couple of years, we had legal online gambling sites in the US, because basically what that 2011 opinion said was, as long as it's not sports betting, the Wire Act doesn't apply. So yeah, New Jersey, Nevada, Delaware all launched online casino, online poker. Fast forward a little bit more to 2018, and we think this is resolved. And no, it's not, because the Trump administration's Department of Justice says, you know what, we're going to look at that, because somebody who is no longer with us said we should look at that. And they revisited it apropos of nothing. So the OLC opinion from 2011 was because states asked, hey, can we do this? 2018 was just, we're deciding to do this. And they said, no, actually, it applies to everything. So they reversed the 2011 opinion. That wound up in the courts. New Hampshire and Neil Pollard sued. They basically won through every step of the way, but it didn't go all the way to the Supreme Court. So there's no finality to the decision. So what happened was IGT said, well, that opinion only applies to Neil Pollard and the New Hampshire Lottery. So we're worried that our non-sports betting things can get prosecuted down the road, because they might say, hey, you guys have been in violation of this law the whole time. So this new opinion basically says, no, you guys are good. There's nothing that's from that opinion that can be transferred differently over to you. So what it does is it says what you're doing now is fine. What it doesn't do is say there's no threat down the road that the Wire Act can't be changed. So it's relieving them from any legal liabilities, because they're saying, no, you're operating within what we understand to be the law at the moment, the interpretation of the Wire Act. But what it's not doing is saying we guarantee that will never change, because it can change. It's changed three times in 20 years based on how the DOJ wants to interpret that specific law. And from 2002 to 2011, I believe there was like 17 prosecutions from online gambling that they went after. So it's not like they haven't done it in the past. And I know I'm going on a little bit, but my opinion on this has always been that 2018 opinion was so poorly written. It was just basically handed from Sheldon Adelson's lobbyists and said, here's what you should do. It was so poorly written and poorly argued that any one of us three could make a better argument. So it's not like another negative opinion couldn't come down the road.
So just so I understand, when you say opinions, it's opinions from a judge or opinions from the Department of Justice or something?
Right. So it's from the Department of Justice. So there's a thing called the Office of Legal Counsel, who basically says, this is how we are interpreting this law at the moment. So marijuana laws in the US, federal government is not prosecuting those at the moment because states have legalized it. They could at any moment just say, you know what, Massachusetts? No, what you're doing is illegal. All these shops are illegal because there is a federal law there. They're just deciding at the moment not to do that. So these opinions are basically the current administration, whoever is running things, is saying, this is how we are interpreting this. And the big problem with the Wire Act is I don't even know if it's, you can consider it English. And if you've ever tried to read the actual statute, you're like, I don't really know what that says. It's the kid who needs to write a book report on the book they didn't read.
Okay. So everything I know about the US legal system, I've learned from Law and Order and Billions, right? So There's a political element to these kind of departments. So as governments change and presidents change or things change, people change, and their views of the world can, the same department's views can dramatically change overnight because of political will. So even though this is a good thing from IGT's perspective right now, like you said, then there's just like a massive asterisk against this of like, you're not out of the woods. Is there like a statute of limitation that kind of kicks in at some point? Or like, is there like a point where there's a line in the sand? Or is this just an ongoing potential liability they need to carry on the books?
To me, this was the biggest misstep of the whole New Hampshire lottery case, was that people looked at it as a win that the DOJ didn't appeal it to the Supreme Court. If they had appealed it to the Supreme Court, I mean, this is a slam dunk case to me. I think there's no question that the 2011 opinion is correct and the 2018 opinion is very incorrect. Michelle Minton has, I think, did the best treatise on the Wire Act way back in like 2014. It's still available online. It's just a great overview of what it was meant to do, like the actual reasoning behind the law and how it's being just poorly applied because there are no other laws in place that deal with this. So these opinions can change whenever. There's nothing stating this. Now, as we've seen in recent times with other issues, the Supreme Court can overrule their own opinions on different things. So these aren't, just the higher up you go, the more concrete or the more final the decision is. So if you codify it into law, if Congress goes and they say, you know what, we need to amend this law so that it reads properly and it applies to internet gambling, then you have a much better buffer zone against it. Obviously, the law can change down the road. 20 years from now, there might be some prohibition type effort. You never know, but there is no finality to what happened with the IGT case. What it is, the only thing people are rightly positive about is the whole toothpaste back in the tube business. Sports betting, there's nothing you can do about it, and which the Wire Act clearly applies to sports betting. So why isn't anybody trying to apply it to sports betting? They just don't. It's too late. Online casino and online poker in the US isn't as widespread. So there is still that. It still could be damned off at where it is now. I mean, you're inviting all kinds of lawsuits from states that are already legal. You're inviting all kinds of issues. But I've seen crazier things happen. I mean, seen crazier things happen recently. So it's not a finality by any means. I think it's getting less and less of an issue. I think it would take a lot more for another DOJ to go down this road again, especially because the person who was singularly behind this is no longer with us. Like Sheldon Adelson was driving this entire effort. And you can even see Las Vegas Sands now getting into different areas of online gambling. So it seems that this has cooled off, but you never know what happens in 2 years.
Super. It's a bit weird when we get like, you know, really experty people on, because we're just both sitting here like, fuck. I feel like Father Dougal.
These cows are close up, those cows are far away.
Yeah.
Best episode. You had another topic, John, for today, didn't you? There was two.
Did I?
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Well, I mean, there's the perennial topic. Have you watched all of season 5 of Cobra Kai yet, Steve?
Of course. Me and my wife already binged it, yeah. Took two nights.
What were your thoughts?
No spoilers. I'm only on episode 2.
Oh, okay.
Spoil away.
So without spoilers, no, it's good. I've liked every season. Like I love the character arcs. I think it's just corny enough that it works. Like the cheese factor of it is just perfect.
It's did like you guys know... cry when Johnny died?
No spoilers, but yeah. It does get a little dark near the end, but then it quickly cheeses itself back up into a G.I. Joe cartoon where lasers are firing everywhere and everyone's all right, but... Yeah, big Cobra Kai fan.
That's why I asked. Mind you, it's one of my big annoyances in movies is like, it's when people are like, and let's be fair, it's nearly always American movies, but then maybe that's just because there's so fucking many. It's when somebody gets shot in the shoulder, and it's always treated as an inconsequential place to be shot. Think how many working parts there are in the shoulder. Think how little you can do if you have a simple strain of the rotator cuff muscles on your shoulder. and then think a piece of metal moving through that, dislodging every single piece of tissue it comes into contact with, spreading as it goes, pushing it all out the other side. Are you really going to have a fight and punch somebody with that arm afterwards? I'm thinking no.
I like Die Hard for this. So at the end of that movie, he is beat to hell. But before he goes to the hospital, he needs to introduce his wife to his new cop friend. And it's like, what are we doing here? Like, nobody's like, dude, you got to lay down. We can get you to the hospital here. You lost 4 pints of blood out of your feet. Let's go.
It's the walking on the glass and the barefoot that, like, anybody who's had a blister, you're like, you're not doing that. Oh.
So yeah, I watched the new recent Scream movie, and like I love horror films generally. They're highly highly amusing to me. But so right at the end of Scream, you've got somebody who's been stabbed about 8 times. You've got somebody else that's been shot in the stomach, and the bullet wound's right around the liver as well. So if it hasn't hit the liver, it's gone straight through her kidneys at the back. So, yeah, you got that as well. And other people who've had the shit kicked out, them being stabbed, being, you know, all kinds of things. But those two in particular. And they're, you know, as they're getting into the ambulance, and this guy's been stabbed to shit, left for dead. He's that stabbed. And as he's on the gurney, he's been put in the ambulance, he's all like, you're thinking... No, there would be blue lights. They'd be getting your ass in there as fast as they can. None of this relax shit. None of your friend going over and going, you'd be fine. You'd be fine. No, you probably won't. Yeah. But the other one, yeah, okay, so it was one of the big stars. But, you know, shot in the stomach, you're not going to be getting up, being involved in the whole denouement. You're actually going to be probably just lying there screaming. Hence the name of the movie, I thought.
And then there's
I'm not asking for total realism. Right? I'm not asking for this to be like a documentary, but let's be a little bit, you know, because I'm pretty sure. So I was watching it with the kids, and I'm pretty sure they're going to grow up thinking that you can tackle any psychopathic killer, and it doesn't matter if you get shot. What kind of lesson is that for a 5-year-old?
But you've seen, have you seen the John Woo movies where they do like the two guns?
Yep.
And then you've seen guys at gun ranges trying to do that, and they end up shooting themselves in the wrist.
Turn it on the side as well.
Or doing the side, you know, you just end up like two guns,
you can only focus on one thing. But there's the opposite of that, because then there's the movies where you punch somebody in the face and knock them out, and they're knocked out for like 3 hours, or you shoot them once and they're just completely movement. There's no movement at all. It's like, that's not how that, like, it's either like so over the top that you can't kill the person, or the slightest thing just incapacitates them completely.
Neck breaks as well.
That's another good one.
It's always like you break the neck. Oh, dead. Just dead straight away. No, they'd probably be lying on the floor saying, well, this is embarrassing. I don't appear to be able to move. And I believe by the smell, because my nose is working perfectly, I may have shat my pants.
Yeah.
But then there's also other stuff like
in movies.
As a kid, you grow up thinking like quicksand's going to be a really big deal, because they got used quicksand. That, like, there was always a quicksand episode where somebody got caught in quicksand.
But the pinnacle of quicksand was, of course, the Princess Bride with the lightning sand. At the moment I am reading The Princess Bride to my kids.
Oh, that's nice.
With the knowledge that at the end of it, we get to watch the movie, which I'm absolutely over the moon about. So Annie Rose has been saying to me, Dad, who's your favorite actor in the movies, in the Princess Bride movie? I said, well, I like the guy that plays Inigo. I think he's really excellent in the movie. Although apparently Mandy Patinkin's a bit of a bonehead in real life. But he's wonderful in that film. And I said to her, I think you're going to like the guy that plays Fezzik. I said, his name was Andre the Giant. And she's like, huh? And I got to show her some video of Andre the Giant, because she loves wrestling. So I got to show her some footage of this guy. And she's like, but how does it work? Because surely nobody could beat him. I'm like, that's how it worked. That's exactly how it worked. He was so much bigger than everybody else.
I love show the old the YouTube videos when people talk about him, the old wrestlers. And they'll say, like, if he didn't like you, like the stuff he would do, it was bad. Like, so that guy, Big John Studd, he was actually scared to death to wrestle him because basically it was Andre the Giant would step over the top rope when he entered the ring. And when that guy did it, he's like, that's my thing. He just did my thing. And he used to beat the shit out of him in the ring. Like, the guy would actually run out of the ring some nights.
But the stories of Andre the Giant drinking as well. Like, he holds, like, the WWE record for the amount of beers he drank on a flight. Like, it was 80 beers or something.
Yeah.
I think he'd hold that, you know, for anybody of any discipline ever, anywhere.
Yeah.
Because I think I always used to say, like, because I'd always have people, like, you know, drink you under the table or whatever. And, of course, they never, ever did. Because I was a lot heavier than I looked. And body mass is really important when it comes to dealing with alcohol. So there's me sitting there knowing full well I'm like 18 stone in your crappy mathematics, Steve. That's probably about 260 pounds.
Yeah, it's like 22, right? 22 pounds or something. 24, something like that.
So it's 14 pounds 14, to a stone.
14.
You know, so I knew I was safe, and they'd be long on their way to hospital before I got drunk. So when you factor in this guy's like 7 feet tall or whatever, and massive with it, his hand probably wasn't even drunk by then.
It's one of my favorite pictures is him holding a beer can because it doesn't look like it looks like one of those mini cans.
It's like there. It's glorious. Sorry. So, so we got a little sidetrack there. Did we talk about IGT yet?
Not too much. So we have IGT, and there's also, we could also discuss, like, what are the options next? Like, how do we solve this problem?
Yeah. I mean, what does it mean? What's coming? Have we got more nonsense coming? Not that this is nonsense, anybody from IGT that's listening.
Sponsorships are open.
I dug myself out of that one pretty nicely. I'm pretty sure Industrial Light and Gambling are going to come on board with us. They're basing that on nothing at all.
They're going to hire us for the next rebrand. I know that much.
Again, but my consultancy fee just went up.
Heckling from the cheap seats. That's what we're doing, John.
Sorry, Steve. Bring us your expertise.
So I would say there's three ways that the Wire Act could resolve.
Everybody loves a three-way, Steve.
Yeah. This one, maybe not so much. So the first way would be, sorry, that's my dog just playing with a squeaky toy. Just that's what she does. The first way would be that it just never gets talked about again, which is a possibility that whatever has happened so far is what people assume the law is, and nobody's going to bother going down this road again. That is the most likely scenario. The second scenario would be that a new administration issues another opinion. This goes through the courts again after some lawsuits, and it gets to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court makes a decision, most likely in favor of the online gambling side. And I would say that would almost be the final nail in the coffin. There's always a possibility that could get overturned down the road, but that I don't think that's an issue that the court is, or that voters are like, hey, we need Supreme Court justices that are going to overturn this gambling decision. It's just not something that's going to happen. And the third way, which would be the easiest and simplest solution, is that Congress just either amends the Wire Act or passes new legislation dealing with online gambling. The chances of that simple, easy way happening are close to zero because Congress is dysfunctional. And as Chris Grove has said for about a decade now, they can't even pass a budget. Like they're pretty much useless. So the idea that they would just pass some type of sweeping gambling reform for states is almost out of breath. It's not even something that I even consider. But of course, it would be the simple solution, because you would just pass a bill that says, no, this is what this covers. If they were smart, they would leave it open for some future products, just as our current gambling laws don't cover the products that currently exist. The law that's passed next year by Congress, this hypothetical law, would not cover products that are available in 2040. So that would be the greatest way to deal with it. But of course, I would also add the caveat that should Congress decide to go down that road, special interest would come out of the woodwork, and you'd probably end up with a bill that is even worse than the current version of the Wire Act. And people would be just as unclear about what it covers, what's legal, what's not legal. States would be suing, cats and dogs living together, that type of stuff.
Wow. There could conceivably come a point when we look back at the Wire Act fondly then.
Yes, it's not out of the question. Pretty much, I mean, we see it with state laws, and that's far less than what would happen if the federal government decided to get involved, because they'd have to balance states that don't have it, that don't want it, with states that have it, with states that have carve-outs, with tribal gaming policies, and everything else in between. And then you also open up the door to, well, if this is a national law covering online gambling, what does that say about international? What does that suddenly open the door for international compacting? Do servers need to be located in the US? Do they need to be located in states? There's 100 different questions that gets opened. And I think that's why, for the most part, Congress has left gambling as a state level issue. Let each state deal with it as they will. All politics are local, and those types of decisions can be made at the state level without too much fuss. At a national level, there's just such a balancing act that needs to be done. But these existing laws also complicate things, because there are these overhanging laws that states have to also abide by. And I mean, there's 100 reasons why. So that if you look at the Florida situation where they tried to legalize sports betting, and they tried to do that through a compact. And they said, well, as long as the servers are on tribal land, the bets take place on tribal land. Well, that's very unsettled law. And to most people, I think that sounds ludicrous, that somebody could place a bet in Tallahassee and it gets taken on a tribal land server. So therefore, it happens on the server and not in Tallahassee. I think most people believe it's both, wherever that the online communication is happening. So that's what they tried to do. And it's unsettled law. But the problem is, if they win that case, it opens up such a can of worms. Well, if it only happens at the server, then what do state lines even matter? Why can't somebody in Arkansas place a bet in Massachusetts? The bet's taking place at the server. That's what you told us. And if that's the case, why can't it happen in Curacao? Why can't it happen in Malta? Like, what is preventing that if the bet takes place at the server? So winning that argument is actually a bigger problem. That's why I think a lot of places have kind of been very, very reticent to go down that path. We've seen a couple cases. So you have that Desert Rose Bingo attempt. You had Oklahoma Tribe, PokerTribe.com wanted to basically act like the Kahnawakis do in Canada internationally. So there's all these things that are moving at the same time. But the bigger problem is, what are the second and third order effects of actually winning that case? And the same thing might be true of the Wire Act. What is the second and third order effect of, well, it no longer applies to online gambling? Well, what does that mean for what we've known to be the legal structure in the US up to now?
So it sounds like then it kind of goes back to your original point of, you know, sportsbook is, say, so widespread at a state level that it's just not going to be looked at. And in a way, then it just needs more and more states to legalize. And then it just becomes normal. So regardless of the Wire Act, the reality on the ground is very different. States get used to tax revenues, so they're going to be very protective of that. And just, you know, the more states they can legalize over the next couple of years, the better it is long term for the industry.
Yeah, I would say that's my opinion. So
it's that kind of safety in numbers kind of thing. If the exactly. majority is doing this, then that's what the new norm is, regardless. Right.
And sometimes in the US in the legal system, it's not quite what is the correct legal interpretation. You also have to look at what type of harm it would cause if we actually did rule this way. So there's that factor that goes into some legal opinions. I thought lottery would be the one that would also push that tipping point over, but it's kind of stalled since the pandemic.
But lottery is not really considered gambling though, right? So I know from an affiliate perspective, I didn't need a license to promote lottery, but I did.
Regulated by different agencies usually. Sometimes it's the same agency, but oftentimes there's a state lottery, and then there's your gambling, your casino regulators. And typically when you legalize online gambling, it falls into that land-based gambling basket, the casino basket. But in states that don't have casinos, it has fallen under the purview of the lottery. So like New Hampshire, Tennessee, their sports betting industries are regulated by the lottery. So it can fall in both. The lottery is usually quite more open about affiliates and things like that.
They had kind of like slots games kind of thing. It was quite, amazing.
Yeah, a few of them have very
scratch cards and stuff like that.
VLTs, so basically the difference between an online slot and an online instant win game through the lottery is how the random number generator is used. So slot random number generators are always based on a reel. So even your video lottery terminals and your video gaming terminals are slightly different in how the internal mechanisms work. So that's how they get around those two things. But yeah, it's those games that are available in like Michigan, Pennsylvania, those are slot machines. They're just very slow pace of play slot machines.
I was just thinking that, you know, that this just looks like it's going to drag and drag and drag. Because any potential legislation, and obviously there isn't going to be any at federal level because, you know, from the outside it seems too sensible. When you explain it from the inside, it would just be opening up a can of worms. And what happens in my head then is I think, did that expression come about because somebody actually canned some worms? And then like forgot about them and they were like, what should we eat this winter? Well, little Tommy, let's have a look and see what we stored in the spring. I'm sure there's something delicious. Oh my word, we canned some worms. What an error that was. I hope you're hungry, little fellow.
I googled it.
Tommy that did that.
It's definitely him, little bastard.
I googled it. The general consensus traces it back to the 1950s in the US and literal cans of worms. Yeah. Fishermen used to buy sealed metal cans of earthworms as opposed to the plastic containers or styrofoam cups today. There you go.
I wonder what they're kept in. I wonder if they're kept in like, you know, like a bit of like a sweet syrupy juice so you could drink it afterwards. Or I don't know.
So that's the 1950s? I didn't realize we were back on the metal train so fast after the war. I would have figured that they wouldn't have used metal that that senselessly.
Yeah, but if it was America, you're all like, look at our natural resources. And everybody else is like, we've got nothing.
Well, America's sitting pretty now. Energy independent. That's nice.
We're nowhere near what's going on over in Europe, which is ridiculous when I see what people are.
You mean the natural gas pipeline from Russia that's just been turned off? Like everything's fine.
Was it like 200-something% increase in energy bills?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like gas
plus
goes up
rampant
to,
inflation. Yeah.
So I know we have, so our gas is always lower, but it's because it's subsidized by the government. That's mostly why the price is kept low. But when it went up to like $5, it was like $5 a gallon. People were, you would have thought that, you know, we were on an embargo and there was no gas anywhere and there were cars stranded on the side of the road.
Oh, it was still like half the price it is in the UK.
Yeah, Yeah.
Even before it got expensive.
When I lived in Germany, I was like, look at these gas prices. And then somebody's like, yeah, that's for a liter. And I'm like, holy shit. And then when I came back, I was like, how is the gas so expensive? And then I just realized that we pay for it through our taxes. So we give subsidies to the companies to keep the prices low. So taxpayers.
There are two other big differences though. And one is like, and I always laugh my ass off when I'm in the US because I see an advert for a car on TV and it'll be like, this car does 15 miles to the gallon. And it's like this big selling point. And it's like, you know, in the UK, that might as well be an actual drag car.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just wouldn't sell that. You know, I mean, it would have to be like the most luxury vehicle in the history of luxury for anybody to even look at 15 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, it's
we're selling 30, 40, whatever miles to the gallon. But also in the US, your towns and cities were generally built later than most of Europe, with, you know, obviously a couple of exceptions. But most of your roads are pretty straight and you don't have like, so like, I know people in Los Angeles who drive down to Vegas and they're like, yeah, we'll just drive down to Vegas this weekend. Yeah. And if you did that in the UK, you'd take a blanket, you'd take snacks, you'd take some kind of flare because, you know, that's like a 5-6 hour drive and you're going to be in Scotland by the end of it. But the difference is the 5-6 hour drive from Los Angeles to Vegas, you're going in a straight line on a straight road. In the UK, you're probably not even going to get into your car's top gear for more than an hour of that journey.
Yeah, that's what Massachusetts is very much like that. Like Boston is one of the worst laid out cities. There's been times where like you see the building you want to go to, but you can't get to it. And you take like the next turn and you have to leave the city and come back into the city again and try again. It's almost like a video game where, oh, you died. You have to start all over from the last checkpoint.
I just think that's the Irish influence on Boston. That's like any city in Dublin. Like there's a metro system they built in Dublin that was a decade late and massively over budget.
Probably built by the English then.
It was the Dutch, actually. They were so far behind, they just stopped. So we've got this north line and south line that don't join up in the city because the city center is like the most difficult bit to do of any metro system. So they just stopped it. Like, we'll just stop it now and launch it. And you've got to walk across the city. So you got like a 20-minute walk across the city to get to the other line. And that for me was like the most Irish approach to like just civil works.
We had this thing in Boston called the Big Dig. If you want a good rabbit hole to laugh and go down, just like Google the Big Dig in Boston. And so union workers were basically doing this. And they kept changing the plans so often that what they would do is they'd dig a hole on one side and then they'd transport all that dirt to the other side. And then the next day they'd transport it back until the planners came up with the actual plan. So it was just like moving dirt back and forth the street for like months. It turned out to be like one of the biggest wastes of money. And it didn't really help traffic that much. It was supposed to like alleviate all the traffic.
Yeah, traffic will always fill a space, won't it? Fintan, have I forgotten anything that I said we were going to talk about?
No, we've covered everything.
Awesome. And some other stuff that we weren't expecting.
We didn't ask about which Cobra Kai dojo you would be.
That's a good shout.
That's our new follow-up Cobra Kai question.
Good shout. What's your spiritual dojo?
Which one's your Hogwarts house?
I think I know where he's going to go with this.
So I would say this is such a tough question because it depends on the person who walks through the door.
Obviously, you've got three choices, right?
It would never be Cobra Kai. Like, it just, that's just ridiculous. That's just being an asshole. Every now and then you need a little Eagle Fang though. So most people need Miyagi-Do, but every now and then if somebody might need some Eagle Fang.
Yeah. I had you down as an Eagle Fang, that kind of chaotic neutral kind of.
I was thinking you'd go Eagle Fang as well.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
But I remain alone in my dojo.
I do not believe in the there is no first strike in karate line. I believe that is a bastardized version of the actual say, which is you do not initiate the problem. But if the problem arises, you're well within your rights to hit first.
Maybe that's just a very North American interpretation, though.
So it, there's a gentleman called Ian Abernathy who does a lot of looks into the old karate guys, the old karate masters, and the translations are just a little bit off. That's what it is. So one of the terms that you hear a lot is uke. So ajayuke, like a rising block. So everybody thinks that's a block. But the term uke actually means to receive. So it's not, the translations are always like slightly off. So you don't always get the perfect interpretation.
That happens a lot, especially with older Eastern texts. Because, and it's a true story, the very, very famous document, The Art of War, actually was originally called The Art of Knitting.
Thanks, John.
I like the Zen and the motorcycle repair. I like those how they've done all those offshoots of that. How it's just, it applies to everything. It could very well be The Art of Knitting because basically every concept in it is just a general life lesson for anything you do.
And knitting is dangerous.
It can be.
Yeah.
I bet knitting Twitter is a hell of a place.
Oof, I bet it's evil. My brother was once twatting around with a crochet needle and he pretended to throw it at me and he lost his balance. But you could see it was pushing against the skin on the back of his hand, so it went most of the way. And of course, a frigging crochet needle, you're not just going to pull it out. Oh, how I laughed. I guess we weren't the most sympathetic to each other growing up.
You got to laugh at that first. Like, and then like, you okay?
Totally.
I came out of a wood pile once. We were playing wiffle ball. Came out of a wood pile and had a board attached to my foot because I stepped on a nail.
Oh,
and
nice.
Everybody was just laughing at me as like I was hopping around on one foot. I had to push it off with my own hands, which was not fun.
That's a little bit diehard right there.
It had to come off. It was a pretty heavy board.
And it would have made driving yourself to the hospital really inconvenient, I would have thought, even in an automatic.
Especially at 11 or however old I was.
I was going to say, that is quite early to be going to A&E.
He's on fire.
I wish. I am quite chilly. Steve Reddick, one last tiny question. I appreciate people can't see this, but on the wall behind you, possibly on a curtain, you have a bunch of caps. Is that a cap for each time wages.com has changed its name?
No. So I've got a few sports hats up there. Boston teams. There's a PokerStars hat up there. There's a Encore Boston Harbor hat up there for some reason. And Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. No wages.com hats. I haven't gotten that swag bag yet. Or props.com, American affiliate.
I'll send you the bonus yet. Finder one. We'll get that up there as well. We'll represent. We can swing that out.
He will.
I have an old Cryptologic hat around here somewhere.
Oh, nice. That'll be worth something.
Yeah.
I used to have a QVC one.
From my Rake the Rake days when I was signed up through Rake the Rake.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Jesus, you've been around, Steve. And not just with one employer. I'll get my coat. Steve, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Anytime. And an education. Thanks,
always fun.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.